Welcome, everybody. The theme for the day was under the heading of devotion and ritual and monastic lifestyle, so that there's going to be some pictures, a bit of video, a lot of talking, show and tell, and so that it's going to be a bit of a scramble in terms of how we can, which way to face, which way to, where it's happening, but we'll, we're trying to make it up as we go along. The taking the monastic lifestyle as a kind of theme to be able to explore in terms of what might be relevant for lay life and especially for upasika, one who is drawing close to the teachings, and so that because certainly in a traditional Buddhist culture, then many aspects of the monastic form end up getting filtered into the lay life and become a part of the customs and traditions, and oftentimes without even knowing sometimes where it comes from. Sometimes it's conscious, sometimes it's just sort of makes it its way in, so that particularly being in say in America, which is definitely not a Buddhist culture, there are, there's possibly aspects of the monastic life, monastic culture training that are useful to be incorporating into either people's daily lives or into certain areas of ceremony or formal structures that can be helpful. And I think these are today, we're going to be presenting, various information, and I think it's a lot of it is just seeding people's minds and consciousness as to what might be possible, what might be useful. In the later part of the afternoon, we'll be exploring some of the more ritual aspects, taking leave, formally paying respects, taking leave of the teacher when a monk is going to go to another monastery, or they're going to study somewhere, or going off traveling or something like that, they'll take formal leave. And that's actually something that, say within Thai culture, then that's very much a part of when you go off somewhere, you take leave of your parents, you take leave of your grandparents, if you're going off to study, you're going off to school, then it's a natural part of the, what is considered appropriate, and it both increases the kind of bonds of affection and respect within the family and within that social structure. So, that's an interesting thing that has gone into Thai culture, and what might be a useful way of incorporating into a Western culture, or not. I mean, there's a lot of things that we'll explore today that could be useful and are certainly, I think, worthy of reflection. Some of the things are just aspects of developing mindfulness with the ordinary things around you. In the monastic training, there's the Buddha was, say, contrary to some images of him being some sort of cosmic Buddha, not very tangible and not really present with people, or some cosmic principle. And he was in very much involved with the daily life, nitty-gritty of how life functioned. And the Buddha was incredibly particular in how he wanted the monastics to be looking after their bowls, their robes, their dwelling places, the actual areas of the monastery, looking after things on a communal basis as well as on a personal basis. So that's those are really helpful models. I think of one of the duties of the monastics is going off on alms round, and Sariputta, who is known for his wisdom, that's his sort of distinguishing characteristic, is his wisdom, but part of his daily routine would be when the monks went off on alms round, he would usually take the last alms round route, and then he would go around the monastery and make sure everything was neat and tidy. And just clean up, make sure everything's neat and tidy. Sort of, here's this, the whole kind of, all the texts of Abhidhamma are built up on the assumption of Sariputta's discernment and oftentimes it's that model of him being incredibly analytical. But he wasn't just this intelligent thinker. He was an actual doer as well. And it's incredible. It's important that the Dhamma and the Buddhist teachings are not just about, it's not just a nice philosophy. It's something that you want to learn how to live and learn how to apply. Also, I think another aspect of the learning some of these monastic protocols, how monastic lives. I think the more lay people that know how to, that are comfortable in terms of how monastics live, then they can both not be intimidated by a monastic presence, and then also actually know how to look after things, go and be able to help out, knowing how to wash a monk's bowl, something very simple. And then the monastic is actually comfortable to let their bowl be washed by a layperson, because it's something that's our one requisite, and if somebody takes it and clunks it around and scrapes it and drops it, then we don't want to take the chance of having somebody do that. So that if somebody knows how to look after amongst bol or monastics requisites, then it's much easier for those people to draw close to the monastics. I'm thinking, say, there was just the retreat at Spirit Rock where Ajahn Sujita was teaching, and there were there three monks and about 10, 11 female monastics, and there was a lot of kerfuffle at first. What do we do with them? And you know, so by actually learning, being comfortable, being familiar, then you say, oh yeah, I can do that. I can draw close to them. I can help out. One can be either be of service or feeling comfortable to actually approach them rather than just, they just do everything so weird. I don't know if I can go close or not. You know? So it's a helpful way of having that knowledge of monastic protocols it helps to increase that interdependence of the monastic community and the lay community, so that bond becomes stronger and more comfortable. Another aspect is just that I think there are kind of details of monastic life or monastic training that are, and this is obviously biased perspective, but I think they're intrinsically interesting to me in that sense of it's a different way of doing things. It's a different way of even thinking, different way of approaching things. It's just like when people hear that, say, like right now, there's two of the monks from Bhayagiri are on the road walking up to the Pacific Hermitage, and there's two monks on their own, and you start sort of thinking that through a bit. Okay, they got no money. They can't store food. They can't even ask for food. They have to rely on people. Wow, that's really different. How are they doing that? Well, how does that work? And then the word. And of course, yesterday, people met up with them, and Ajahn Sudanta sort of said, "Well, yeah, they've had all these incredible opportunities of meeting people, and have these really touching interactions and quite profound engagement with ordinary people along the route going out to the coast and up the California coast." And so it's kind of interesting. It works. I think those are a few in terms of overview. I think that's those are perspectives. Anything else?
Share an anecdote.
Yeah. Good.
So I just remember at Daodam. I was a senior monk at Daodam. This is a monastery in the Burmese border, and we had this this woman who's the cook in the monastery, and she was kind of challenging to get along with. And one day after, it was like a Sunday or something, we were cleaning up the kitchen. I went down to the kitchen and I was kind of helping the tenants direct things and cleaning it up. And the three old ladies kind of came to the monastery. And they come in the kitchen, and they didn't really speak any Thai. They spoke a bit of Burmese and maybe a little bit of Thai. And they start preparing this tray and some flowers and things, and I kind of assumed that they were going to pay respects to me. And they kind of get this tray together, and there's flowers and betel nuts, and then they get down and they pay respects to the cook. Maybe Mother's Day or her birthday or something. They just came up to pay respects to her, and then turned around and left. And it was really sweet.
Yeah, that's a perfect example of the where something that is from the monastic training, it's part of it, but it's integrated into cultural aspects and into people's daily lives. So that's a great opportunity to do that. Yeah.
Did they bow her?
Yeah, they gave her the tray, they bowed, and they did the whole kind of asking for forgiveness, the ceremony that we do. It was really like full on, even more than I've ever seen in Thailand. I think they also do it in Thailand, but I've never actually seen it firsthand. Where the lay people did it to like their, it wasn't even like a relative, it was just like an elder.
Yeah.
Like she was older than they were. Yeah. Even though they were old themselves, I mean, they were. Well, that's it.
They must have been almost 60, eh?
What we'll be seeing today, is this all steeped in the canon, and then, or is some of it stemming from Thai forest, like Thai culture and Thai forest tradition?
It's the opposite, in the sense that it comes from the canon, virtually all of it, and then it's entered the culture, it's entered the monastic culture, it's entered the lay culture. So pretty much all of it. Are things that are protocols or trainings that have been are from the canon and particularly the Vinaya, and that's really in terms of, I think most people are familiar with the suttas, the discourses of the Buddha, and the Buddha gives teachings and answers questions, and it's all around the formal aspects of the either meditation or Dhamma aspects. But the texts, the Vinaya texts, are all around the training and protocols. And the Buddha was just as particular and just as thorough in his laying out ways of doing things, because sometimes also the Buddha lays out a rule for training, and it's usually waiting for something to, okay, something's off, something's not right. The Buddha lays down a rule in order to sort of get the training back to something that's a standard that he finds acceptable, and then maybe it's too strict and it gets too difficult for people, so then he loosens it in a certain way, gives exceptions, or it's too loose, so he needs to tighten it up a bit more. So there's a lot of amending of rules, and then the Buddha going through different ways of really walking people through how to look after a bowl or looking after the dwelling place. Things get left outside and get rained on. There's an offense for leaving furniture outside and getting rained, and so that it's to protecting it and bring it inside. It's really basic, nitty gritty. But the Buddha paid attention to that level of detail. It wasn't just some airy fairy, up in the head kind of thing. It was really this is a the training encompass all of those different aspects of life. And it's kind of similar to where the story that Ajahn Chah gives of the monk who's you know, he's been listening to Ajahn Chah's teachings on letting go, and then there's a storm and part of his roof blows off and he just moves his stuff to the other side of the dwelling place and Ajahn Chah, after some time Ajahn Chah notices this and says, you know, what are you doing? This is your requisite. You need to look and say, you know, you've been teaching us about letting go, and I let go to this extent. I'm not sure. I can't tell what you want. letting go doesn't include ruining things or not taking care of what is actually yours or is a communal property. So that either personal things or community, because even our personal things, these are they're offered by the lay community, so they need to be looked after.
One thing that might be interesting, just to, I wonder if we can comment on the 10 reasons the Buddha laid down the Patimokkha. That's a really interesting.
I have that. The 10 reasons why the Buddha laid down the training, the Patimokkha is the rules of training, the 227 rules of the monk, and he's talking to Upali, who is the head, the foremost monk in knowledge of the discipline of the Vinaya, and he was actually a lower caste. A barber, and he ordained with Ananda and Anuruddha, and they actually asked him to ordain before him to be like first, so that he would be senior to them, and because they said that normally as Sakyans and the warrior caste, they have a lot of views and opinions and attachments to their position and authority. So have this barber be senior to them. So anyway, he ended up being extremely knowledgeable of the training. And the 10 grounds, first one's for the well-being of the Sangha. So that's easy. The second is for the ease of the Sangha. So that, I mean, they're kind of similar. Keeping things comfortable. Third one is for keeping recalcitrant persons in check. So that when you've got and it really is kind of self-selecting in the sense that if you've got a lot of training rules that you've set a standard, you've got the bar like this, then oftentimes you don't have to be going around and disciplining and forcing people to follow rules. It's sort of like, because it's voluntary. So then if people don't want to do it, then, you know, one is that there's a certain sort of container, because in any community, especially as they're larger, then there's always people who are yeah, recalcitrant is a good word, but it gives them a container. But then, if it's really onerous, then yeah, they'll oftentimes they'll back off. And then that fourth one, so that well-behaved bhikkhus can dwell at ease. A fifth one is for the restraint of the taints. Asavas, or underlying defilements pertaining to future lives, so it's just holding those in check. Seventh is so that those without confidence might gain confidence, so that in terms of both within the Sangha as well as the lay community, so that when there's a good standard of conduct and training, it gives confidence to people. And the eighth is for increasing the confidence of those with confidence. Again, it's sort of it's supportive. The ninth is for the continuation of the good Dhamma and Sad Dhamma, so that the teaching can be well established and stable and carry on into the future. And the last one is for promoting discipline, that sense of training and container that I don't know about anybody else, but I certainly need a container and help. You know, I've got good intentions most of the time, but it's helpful to have container to keep on track.